It's Tuesday, the 3rd of June, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader and flying staff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Bitcoin goes all in on MAGA, shedding its libertarian slant. Ukraine's assault scrambles Kremlin strategy. And law firms that appeased Trump face backlash. Starting with that first headline, Bitcoin goes all in on MAGA, shedding its libertarian slant. Despite wins under Trump, some crypto factions are wary of politicizing industry. This is by Kevin T. Dugan, Vicky Guy Hong, and Caitlin Ostroff, Las Vegas. The cryptocurrency world was once the province of libertarians who kept their distance from the government. These days, it's in the midst of an all-out MAGA takeover. Take the scene at the industry's flagship event in Las Vegas last week. Star speakers at the Bitcoin conference included a parade of Trump officials and Washington allies. Crypto boosters, including billionaire Bitcoin evangelist Michael Sayer, got a private audience with Vice President J.D. Vance to push their favored policies. A retail store hawked Trump hats, bobbleheads, martini glasses, and sequined shirts. Two Tesla Cybertrucks were wrapped in orange, Bitcoin's unofficial color. A felon pardoned by Trump was feted at a welcome back party that cost $300 per person. The Bitcoin conference right now is basically a right-wing rally, said Richard Scottford, a 53-year-old Bitcoin owner who lives in Costa Rica. He said being enamored with powerful people is against the ethos of Bitcoin. The industry, a realm of outsiders who've long clamored for legitimacy, has never had a friendlier U.S. regime in power. President Trump, a Republican, raised millions from crypto executives and is delivering a lot of what the industry craved, dropping Biden-era lawsuits against crypto companies and backing legislation to bring digital tokens into the financial mainstream. Despite the winning streak, Trump's fervent embrace is causing discomfort to some factions of the crypto world, including a wing that has argued since Bitcoin's early days that cozying up to any government is a bad idea. Even some of the president's supporters said they have cringed at the Trump family's push into every corner of the business, from Bitcoin buying to mining to meme coins. Such moves might raise crypto's profile, but they also create substantial conflicts of interest and could jeopardize the industry's push for widespread acceptance, the critics said. Some early Bitcoin stalwarts are wary of the government entering the market. Patrick Merck, who spent years trying to establish the industry's legitimacy as co-founder of the Bitcoin Foundation, warned that Trump's plan to create a national strategic reserve for Bitcoin could be counterproductive. It's supposed to be an apolitical, value-neutral network, he said. If people believe that the U.S. government has a very large stake in its success, I don't know how people will feel about that in other parts of the world. Crypto's comeback wasn't a given. A few years ago, entrepreneur Sam Bankman-Fried, schlubby attire notwithstanding, turned the exchange FTX into a phenomenon worthy of naming rights for a Miami arena and a Super Bowl ad starring Larry David. That gave way to the scandalous FTX collapse in 2022, criminal prosecutions, Bankman-Fried was sentenced to 25 years in prison on fraud charges, and ramped up regulatory scrutiny. The mood is decidedly different now. Bitcoin is trading near record highs. The industry is optimistic that with Trump's backing, legislation to create a regulatory framework for stablecoins, tokens that are pegged to real currencies such as the dollar, will accelerate the mainstreaming of crypto. Big banks, including J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup, are exploring whether to issue their own joint stablecoin, the Wall Street Journal reported. New Labor Department guidance could make it easier to bring cryptocurrency into 401k plans. Time with a Veep. As the Las Vegas conference showed, crypto's elite executives are hardly outsiders. In a ballroom on the third floor of the Venetian Hotel, past 20 security guards and three dividers, Bitcoin enthusiasts pitched Vance in an intimate, hour-long private meeting. Saylor, the executive chairman of Strategy, a software company that's made stocking up on Bitcoin the centerpiece of its business, advocated for tax leniency for Bitcoin miners who perform complex computational feats needed to unlock units of the currency, according to people familiar with their exchange. Saylor argued that miners should only pay taxes on sales of tokens. He likened the status quo to if a movie studio had to pay taxes on a script based on the prediction that it would be a blockbuster. The event was organized by Gemini, a crypto exchange controlled by the Winklevoss twins of Facebook founding lore. Name cards seen by a journal reporter bore the logo for MAGA Inc., a pro-Trump super PAC. Donald Trump Jr. and White House crypto advisor David Sacks were among the other people at the event. Sam Kazimian, the founder of stablecoin company Frax, pitched the ability for taxpayers to use dollar peg tokens to pay taxes. Vance didn't indicate what he might do, but spoke about the need to make the industry more legitimate, three people who were there said. Tina Mattia, a former telecom worker from New Zealand, has been into Bitcoin for 5 years and came to the conference for the first time, drawn by Trump's political message of anti-wokeness. She's troubled by Trump's own foray into crypto coins. The top holders of Trump's meme coin recently were invited to dinner with the president, drawing criticism from Democrats and government watchdog groups. "I'd not buy it, even though I respect the man," Mattia said. Early idealists. Bitcoin was championed in its early days by libertarian idealists who dreamed of a currency that was totally private and secure outside the reach of governments and financial institutions. Earlier conferences were concerned with the finer details of money and personal liberty and were attended by more paranoid types, Bitcom developer Taj Dryja said. "We were like, well, are they going to bomb this place and kill us all because they want to destroy Bitcoin?" he said. Eventually, a more pragmatic approach took hold, one that sees joining with governments and financial institutions as a way to make Bitcoin valuable in daily life, as a store of value or a way to buy things. As much as the early adherents to Bitcoin were libertarians that imagined it could exist in its own world, we do live in the real world, said Dan Moorhead, the CEO of Pantera Capital, a cryptocurrency-focused investment firm. And the real world has regulators, and the government will be involved. A free man. The MAGA impact on crypto land was on display with the celebration of Ross Ulbricht, the founder of Silk Road, a market for illicit drugs that use Bitcoin as payment for transactions. In January, Trump granted Ulbricht a full pardon of his conviction on drug trafficking charges, saying his life sentence was too harsh. During Ulbricht's 2015 trial, prosecutors said Ulbricht had ordered the assassinations of six people, which he denied. There was no evidence anyone was killed. "He said he would free me, and he did. Period. He's a man of integrity," Ulbricht said of Trump during his conference remarks. The conference also held an auction for clothes Ulbricht wore while incarcerated, as well as his prison ID and paintings he made while in custody. One painting sold for more than a Bitcoin, or about $105,000. And that's Bitcoin Goes All In on MAGA shedding its libertarian slant. Next, we have Ukraine's assault scrambles Kremlin strategy. Surprise drone strike on warplanes hurts ability to attack U.S. other distant rivals. This is by Daniel Michaels and Jane Litvinenko. Kyiv, Ukraine. Ukraine's unprecedented drone strikes on Russian Air Force bases weakens Moscow's ability to wage war on its smaller neighbor and undermine its capacity to threaten more distant rivals such as the U.S., a shift with potentially far-reaching geostrategic implications. A sizable portion of the fleet Moscow uses to launch guided missile attacks on Ukraine and would rely on to strike adversaries in the event of nuclear war was damaged or destroyed in the attacks Sunday. The strikes cast a cloud over peace talks in Istanbul on Monday, where the two sides met for just more than an hour with little progress toward an agreement. Ukrainian officials said the two sides agreed on further exchanges of prisoners of war. Both sides sent low-level delegations reflecting slim hopes of any breakthrough. Russia no longer produces the decades-old Tupolev planes that were targeted in the attacks, meaning it has lost a cornerstone of its ability to project military power beyond its borders. Newer Russian planes are more modern and agile, but lack vital characteristics of the destroyed bombers, most significantly their range and the quantity of munitions they can carry. Ukraine, an open-source intelligence analyst, said the attack also destroyed a rare Antonov plane Russia uses for airborne command and control, another capability vital to modern warfare. Of more than 100 Tupolev bombers that Russia is known to have, Ukraine said it had damaged or destroyed more than 40. Open-source intelligence analysts counted at least 14 damaged aircraft using satellite images and video posted online. It's unclear how many of the Tu-22s and Tu-95s were operational before the strikes. Russia confirmed some losses, saying it repelled part of what it called a terrorist attack. It offered no evidence of repelling the strikes. Lieutenant General Vasyl Malyuk, head of Ukraine's main security and intelligence agency, the SBU, said on Monday the order to destroy the warplanes had come directly from President Volodymyr Zelensky. The enemy bombed our country from these planes almost every night, and today that actually felt that payback is inevitable, Malyuk said. After the drone strikes, Russia will be forced to rethink how it operates, stores, and defends its remaining strategic bomber fleet. Russia, like the U.S., often leaves long-range bombers parked outside and easily visible, both for operational reasons and as part of nuclear disarmament agreements with Washington around the end of the Cold War. Moscow has been compelled by Kyiv's steady drone strikes inside Russia to relocate most of the planes to bases far from Ukraine. Indeed, the remoteness of the bases hit on Sunday is part of what made the carefully planned strike so unexpected. The most distant is about 3,000 miles from Kyiv. Keeping planes far from Ukraine has meant Russian bombers must take long flights to reach targets, giving Ukraine and Western intelligence agencies chances to observe and prepare for their movement, also adding complexity to Moscow's attack plan. Russia will now need to devote more resources to protecting bombers and other valuable military assets. The country has a vast air defense system, but it lacks sufficient equipment to cover the entire country and protect against all dangers from long-range missiles to small, slow drones like those used on Sunday. Zelensky said on Sunday that the attacks on four bases had been prepared and launched inside Russia. The intelligence feat will sow fear within the country and likely prompt Moscow to tighten internal controls and repression. President Vladimir Putin of Russia, who is seen by many Western intelligence analysts as deeply paranoid, is likely to grow more concerned about internal enemies and take harsh measures in response to the public humiliation. Russia has used the warplanes to bombard Ukraine with bombs, missiles, and drones, hitting a range of civilian targets and killing or wounding thousands of civilians. The planes Ukraine hit fill a role in Russia's air fleet, roughly comparable to the U.S.'s B-52 and B-1 bombers. The U.S. also has stealthy B-2 flying wing bombers and is developing a successor, the B-21. In total, the U.S. has about 140 operational long-range bombers. Tu-95s, which first flew in the 1950s as the Soviet Union was developing long-range jet engines, instead use four turbine engines, each with a pair of external propellers that rotate in opposite directions for speed and thrust. But Russia faces a bigger problem than the age of its planes, which isn't an inherent flaw. B-52s were designed in 1949, and U.S. plans to keep around 76 of them flying until at least 2050 because of modernizations. The deeper issue for Moscow is that its aviation industry shows no sign of being able to design and produce a plane that fills the role of the Tupolevs. If Ukraine destroyed nearly as many as it has claimed, the loss would represent a deep blow to Russia's status as a global superpower. The long-range bombers represent vital parts of Russian and U.S. ability to deliver nuclear weapons in a war. The other two legs of the nuclear triad are submarines and land-based missiles. Russia's Navy has struggled in recent years to maintain and modernize its equipment. The readiness of its land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles and their launch silos is difficult to gauge. The damage to Russia's nuclear deterrent comes as countries in Europe have been stepping up spending on nuclear weapons. On Monday, the UK said it would build up to 12 new nuclear-powered submarines by the late 2030s and spend £15 billion, or $20.3 billion, upgrading its nuclear warhead arsenal. The investment is aimed primarily at deterring aggression from Russia and putting its long, underfunded military back in shape. And that's Ukraine's assault scrambles Kremlin strategy. Our next article is by Aaron Mulvaney, Emily Glazer, C. Ryan Barber, and Josh Dawsey. Law firms that appeased Trump face backlash. Some big clients split with firms that struck deals with the White House. At a recent luncheon at Cipriani in Midtown Manhattan, a top lawyer for Citadel delivered a message to leaders of some of the country's biggest law firms. Brooke Cuccinella told them that the hedge fund company likes to work with law firms that aren't afraid of a fight. Cuccinella, head of litigation and regulatory inquiries at the business headed by Republican mega-donor Ken Griffin, made no mention of politics, but some of the lawyers in attendance took her remarks as reference to a controversy that's been roiling the legal industry. Some of the listed attendees work for firms that had cut deals with the White House to avoid punitive executive orders by President Trump. Others were at law firms that had gone to court to fight them. Support for the law firms that didn't make deals has been growing inside the offices of corporate executives. At least 11 big companies are moving work away from law firms that settled with the administration or are giving or intend to give more business to firms that have been targeted but refuse to strike deals, according to general counsels at those companies and other people familiar with those decisions. Among them are technology giant Oracle, investment bank Morgan Stanley, an airline, and a pharmaceutical company. Microsoft expressed reservations about working with a firm that struck a deal, and another such firm stopped representing McDonald's in a case a few months before a scheduled trial. In interviews, general counsels expressed concern about whether they could trust law firms that struck deals to fight for them in court and in negotiating big deals if they weren't willing to stand up for themselves against Trump. The general counsel of a manufacturer of medical supplies said that if firms facing White House pressure don't have a hard line, they don't have any line at all. Since late February, Trump has issued a half dozen executive orders that direct agencies to remove law firms' security clearances, limit access to federal buildings, and remove their clients' government contracts, citing connections between those firms and the president's enemies. Trump has said many law firms have weaponized the legal system to hamper the work of the administration. Four firms, Jenner & Block, Perkins Coie, WilmerHale, and Sussman Godfrey, elected to fight the administration in court. The leaders of other firms thought such litigation would destabilize their businesses and send clients running for the exits. In March, one of those firms, Paul Weiss, surprised the industry by reaching a deal with the White House to rescind the order in exchange for providing pro bono work for causes supported by the administration. Eight other firms, including Kirkland & Ellis, Skadden, Simpson Thacher, A&O Sherman, and Latham & Watkins, reached pacts. In total, the capitulating firms, which include some of the industry's largest and best known, agreed to provide about $1 billion in pro bono work. The agreements were supposed to buy peace and allow the firms to move on, but in the weeks since, they've caused rifts between partners, alienated some younger associates, and created problems with some longtime clients. Lost trust. Leaders of the firms that struck deals with the White House said they did so in part to protect their clients who were at risk of losing their government contracts as a result of the White House's executive orders against the law firms. Not long after Latham struck a deal in April, the firm's chair, Richard Trobman, met with Morgan Stanley's chief legal officer, Eric Grossman. People familiar with the meeting said. Grossman heard him out about the firm's reasoning for striking a deal and acknowledged that companies have to do what's best for themselves. Soon after that meeting, Grossman and other Morgan Stanley lawyers communicated to law firms targeted by the White House that hadn't signed deals that they were looking to give them new business, the people familiar with the meeting said. Paul Weiss, a 1,200-lawyer firm that works on many big corporate deals, was one of the first law firms targeted by a Trump executive order. The general counsel of one major financial firm said her anxiety grew by the day when Paul Weiss didn't sue quickly after being hit with the order. When she heard the firm struck a deal with the White House, she said she felt physically ill. A top legal executive at another company said she called partners at Paul Weiss before it cut its deal to reassure the firm she would remain loyal, even though doing so risked millions in government contracts. She was shocked when the firm chair, Brad Karp, announced a deal, she said, and her company has plans to move work away from Paul Weiss. The day after Paul Weiss struck its deal, female general counsels gathered for a conference in Washington. During a panel at the Women's General Counsel Network event, a lawyer stood up and said her company had taken steps that morning to pull its business from Paul Weiss. The lawyer received thunderous applause. About 2 weeks later, McDonald's told the court that star Paul Weiss lawyer Loretta Lynch was withdrawing as its attorney in a high-profile lawsuit accusing the fast food giant of discrimination against black-owned media companies. Lynch, who had served as Attorney General under former President Barack Obama, had been involved with the case for several years. It's unusual for companies to shake up representation close to trial. Karp, Paul Weiss's chair and a longtime Democrat donor, has said he made a difficult choice that was necessary to save the firm. In an internal memo, he called the executive order an existential crisis, saying the firm risked losing partners and clients if it sued to block the order. He's told others that handling the executive order was more difficult than managing the firm through the coronavirus pandemic. Firms that struck deals hope to find solidarity in numbers. The country's largest firm, Kirkland & Ellis, which had about $9 billion in revenue last year, lobbied its peers to sign deals. Trump and the law firms have only disclosed limited details about what pro bono work they've agreed to undertake for the administration. General counsel said that makes it hard for companies to know where conflicts of interest might arise. Trump has taken an expansive view about what is required, openly musing about enlisting the firms to help negotiate trade deals or revive the coal industry. In April, the general counsel of Microsoft, John Palmer, discussed with leaders of Latham his concerns about the deal the firm had struck, including how it could affect Latham's ability to represent Microsoft, especially before the government, according to people familiar with the discussion. On April 17th, Microsoft put its concerns in writing, removing Latham from a list of about a dozen preferred firms that it has vetted to handle outside legal work, according to a document described to the journal. About 2 weeks later, after a series of conversations with Latham's leaders that addressed concerns about potential conflicts, Microsoft returned the law firm to its list of preferred firms. The Latham agreement created concerns about potential conflict of interest issues that could have affected the firm's ability to represent Microsoft, Microsoft's Palmer said in a written statement. Latham's leaders, he said, provided the strong assurances we needed to address our concerns. The law firms named in this article declined to publicly discuss client matters. Leaders of firms that struck deals said their business have continued to thrive and that they've received calls from clients supportive of the deals. They have said the agreements won't force them to take on pro bono work that would create conflicts with existing clients. The firms that chose to sue over executive orders said in court filings that they had fielded calls from anxious clients and lost business because of the orders. Judges have struck down the orders against Wilmer Hale, Jenner & Block, and Perkins Coal, and the order against Sussman Godfrey has been temporarily blocked. Judges have said the executive orders amounted to unconstitutional retaliation against the firms. On a website touting the firm's lawsuit, Jenner and Block said relenting to the White House would mean compromising our ability to zealously advocate for all of our clients and capitulating to unconstitutional government coercion, which is simply not in our DNA. Some general counsel said they're giving new work to the resisting firms in a show of solidarity. Internal strife. At Cadwallader, Wickersham and Taft, managing partner Pat Quinn grew emotional when he announced to fellow partners that their firm, the oldest in New York, had reached a deal for peace with the Trump administration. Days later, in a firm-wide meeting, Quinn said Cadwallader's leadership had strongly considered fighting the Trump administration, but ultimately elected to reach a deal out of a sense of duty to the firm and its clients, according to people familiar with his remarks. Emotions have run high inside some firms that struck deals, particularly among younger lawyers. At Skadden, Simpson, Latham, and Kirkland, some associates have quit over the deals. One associate leaving Simpson wrote in his departure email shared on LinkedIn that he refused to sleepwalk toward authoritarianism. Partners, too, have left some of the firms that made deals. At Sullivan and Cromwell, some lawyers have bristled at the role that co-chair Robert Giffra played in facilitating a deal for Trump to drop an executive order against rival firm Paul Weiss. Giffra, one of Trump's personal lawyers, participated by phone in an Oval Office discussion with the Paul Weiss leader, who was there to work out a deal. Giffra is representing Trump in two New York appeals, one of them a challenge to his conviction in the Stormy Daniels hush money case. Giffra told his partners that taking on cases would give the firm strong ties to the new administration. Trying to quell discontent within his own firm, Giffra told partners at an April meeting that he believed the orders were likely unconstitutional and would be blocked by judges, and that he hoped the White House would stop issuing them, according to people familiar with his remarks. White House aides said they weren't aware of his opposition. Trump remains interested in the orders, and Deputy White House Chief of Staff Stephen Miller and his allies want to keep the threats of more executive orders on the table because they think it dissuades the best lawyers from representing critics of the administration. Miller has repeatedly complained that some of the country's top lawyers took on lawsuits against the Trump administration in the first term, which he and other Trump advisors view as stymieing the agenda of a democratically elected president. The White House's appetite for a fight with the legal industry appears to have waned. There hasn't been a new executive order since early April. And that's law firms that appeased Trump face backlash. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or on the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, available from the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And additionally, you can also listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo. Let's turn now to business and finance here in the Wall Street Journal. For these headlines, Apple appeals EU antitrust order. Meta aims to create ads fully through AI. And Indian tycoon Adani under new U.S. scrutiny. This first article, Apple appeals EU antitrust order. Companies face fines if they're found to flout Digital Markets Act. And this is by Edith Hancock. Apple is challenging an order from the European Union's antitrust watchdog specifying how it needs to make its iOS operating system more compatible with rival tech companies' products under the Digital Markets Act. The EU executive last March told Apple what it thinks it should do to make its iOS devices more compatible with rivals' products, from apps to headphones to virtual reality headsets, to comply with the DMA's interoperability rules designed to curb large technology companies' market power. That means giving software developers and device makers access to certain parts of Apple's operating system that are typically reserved for the company's own products, such as allowing some notifications to show up on rival companies' wearable technology. Apple filed an appeal against that decision to the European Union's General Court in Luxembourg on May the 30th. Appeals at the court aren't typically made public until a few days after they are filed. At Apple, we design our technology to work seamlessly together so it can deliver the unique experience our users love and expect from our products, a spokesperson for the company said Monday. The EU's interoperability requirements threaten that foundation while creating a process that is unreasonable, costly, and stifles innovation. The spokesperson called the rules deeply flawed and added that the EU executive's order obliges Apple to share sensitive information with rivals and poses security risks to European customers. Companies have already requested our users' most sensitive data, from the content of their notifications to a full history of every stored Wi-Fi network on their device, giving them the ability to access personal information that even Apple doesn't see, the spokesperson said. Apple criticized an access request from Meta Platforms last December, just as the Commission initially proposed measures it should adopt to ensure its operating system are functional with rivals' products. Companies face fines of up to 10% of their worldwide annual turnover if the EU decides they are flouting the rules. The Commission can also order them to break up parts of their business in extreme cases. Spokesperson for the Commission said its decisions are fully in line with the DMA. We will defend them in court, the spokesperson said. And that's Apple Appeals EU antitrust order. Our next article is by Megan Borososki and Patrick Coffey. Meta aims to create ads fully through AI. Meta Platforms is betting that automation is the future of ads. The social media company aims to enable brands to fully create and target ads using artificial intelligence by the end of the year, according to people familiar with the matter. Meta's ad platform already offers some AI tools that can generate variations of existing ads and make minor changes to them before targeting the ads to users on Facebook and Instagram. Now, the company aims to help brands create advertising concepts from scratch. AI-powered advertising is part of Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg's grand vision for his company's evolution. Advertising makes up the bulk of Meta's business. It brought in more than 97% of overall revenue in 2024 and funds its multi-billion-dollar investments in AI chips and data centers and for training cutting-edge AI models. Using the ad tools Meta is developing, a brand could present an image of the product it wants to promote along with a budgetary goal, and AI would create the entire ad, including imagery, video, and text. The system would then decide which Instagram and Facebook users to target and offer suggestions on budget, people familiar with the matter said. Meta also plans to enable advertisers to personalize ads using AI so that users see different versions of the same ad in real time based on factors such as geolocation, the people said. A person seeing an advertisement for a car in a snowy place, for example, might see the car driving up a mountain, whereas a person seeing an ad for that same car in an urban area would see it driving on a city street. Increasingly sophisticated AI tools are starting to enable businesses to create full photo and video ads without having to spend the money and hire production crews. Google released a new version of its video generation tool called Veo at its annual developer conference last month that allows people to create short videos from a text prompt. In the not-too-distant future, we want to get to a world where any business will be able to just tell us what objective they're trying to achieve, like selling something or getting a new customer, how much they're willing to pay for each result, and connect their bank account and then we just do the rest for them, Zuckerberg said during the company's annual shareholder meeting last week. On a separate podcast appearance, he called it a redefinition of the category of advertising. Generating ads from scratch with AI could be a boon to small and mid-sized businesses, which represent most of the advertisers on Meta's platforms and often lack big budgets for ad creation. Some big brands are wary of providing Meta with even more control over their advertising efforts, given the company's heft in the business and worry that AI-generated campaigns won't have the same look and feel as human-made ads. Although most tech companies have high hopes for AI-generated ads, some brands say the technology that exists throughout the industry often produces distorted or unusable visuals. Improving the quality of these outputs often requires time and resource-intensive work. Meta's new tools also require a lot of computing power and the creation of unique AI models for each brand, the people said. Newer AI companies are also racing to help advertisers create content. Many brands, for example, are already using third-party tools such as Midjourney and OpenAI's DALL-E to create the ads they place on all digital platforms, including Meta's. Meta said it is exploring how to integrate those tools into its platform. That's Meta aims to create ads fully through AI. Our next headline, Indian tycoon Adani under new U.S. scrutiny. This is by Ben Foldy and Dave Michaels. Gautam Adani, Asia's second richest man, is trying to get the Trump administration to drop foreign bribery charges against him. Instead, he's facing a new front in his fight with prosecutors, a probe into whether his companies are buying Iranian petrochemical products. U.S. prosecutors are investigating whether Adani's companies imported Iranian liquefied petroleum gas, or LPG, into India through the company's Mundra port. A Wall Street Journal investigation into tankers that regularly traveled between Mundra and the Persian Gulf found their behavior often exhibited traits associated with ships seeking to evade sanctions. Adani categorically denies any deliberate engagement in sanctions evasion or trade involving Iranian origin LPG, a company spokesman said. Further, we're not aware of any investigation by U.S. authorities on this subject. The expanding scrutiny by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Brooklyn could prove problematic for Adani's rehabilitation effort. President Trump is rolling back enforcement of longstanding laws against overseas bribery, but has also taken aim at purchasers of Iranian oil and gas products. Any country or person who buys any amount of oil or petrochemicals from Iran will be subject to immediately secondary sanctions, Trump wrote on social media platform Truth Social last month. They'll not be allowed to do business with the United States of America in any way, shape, or form. Adani is a close ally of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and sits atop a group of infrastructure companies bearing his name that's been integral to India's recent economic growth. The public companies have a valuation of around $150 billion, yielding Adani and his family one of the world's largest fortunes. Short seller report. In January 2023, short-selling firm Hindenburg Research published a 33,000-word report alleging the Adani Group had violated Indian securities laws by having Adani family members secretly control swaths of shares through offshore vehicles. The company's stocks plunged but have recovered some of their losses. In November, the group faced a new headwind when U.S. prosecutors charged Adani with fraud, alleging that he orchestrated roughly $250 million in bribes to Indian officials to secure lucrative solar power supply contracts in India. Adani Group called the short seller's report nothing but a lie, and the government allegations against it baseless. Adani has hired high-powered legal firms Kirkland and Ellis and Quinn Emanuel, according to lobbying disclosures. The billionaire's lawyers also met with prosecutors in March in hopes of having the case dropped, according to people familiar with the matter. Six Republican members of Congress have publicly argued that Adani's indictment is at odds with Trump's foreign policy priorities, including a strong trading relationship with India. Trump also issued an executive order pausing prosecutions under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. While the case grew out of a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act investigation, Adani was charged with conspiracy and securities fraud over alleged bribes, not with violating the act itself. Prosecutors are reviewing the activities of several LPG tankers used to ship cargoes to Adani Enterprises, the People said. The Adani spokesman said that importing LPG has been a small but growing part of the company's business, contributing 1.46% of its $11.7 billion in revenue last fiscal year. A journal investigation into a group of LPG tankers making journeys between the Adani-run Mundra port and the Persian Gulf since early 2024 found they show signs that ship trackers say are typically evidence of ships attempting to obscure their activities. A common tactic includes manipulating the ship's automatic identification system, or AIS, which shares a ship's position, according to Tomer Ranin, a maritime risk analyst at Lloyd's List Intelligence, who tracks LPG tankers. Satellite images. One journey in April of last year undertaken by a ship that carried an LPG cargo for Adani, the Panamanian-flagged SMS Bros, demonstrates some of the patterns. The ship was docked at Khor al-Zubair in southern Iraq on April 3, 2024, according to its AIS, which the journal analyzed using Sea Searcher, a Lloyd's List platform. Satellite images from April 3 don't show the SMS Bros at its reported berth in Iraq, but a satellite did capture images of a ship matching the SMS Bros characteristics and length, docked roughly 315 miles to the southeast at an LPG terminal in Tonbuk, Iran. The ship docked in Tonbuk was the SMS Bros, according to Samir Madani, whose service tankertrackers.com has indexed more than 9,000 ships from satellite imagery. By April 7th, the SMS Bros AIS data showed it off the coast of the United Arab Emirates. Its data was adjusted at that time to show it riding lower in the water, which had indicated it had taken on cargo. Its AIS data shows that it departed the night of April 8th, heading south, and by the following day anchored offshore near Sohar, Oman. On April 10th, documents purport that Adani Global PTE contracted the ship to load roughly 11,250 metric tons of LPG at Sohar and ship it to Mundra in India. The ship never appears to have docked in Sohar's port, according to the journal's analysis of the AIS data. From there, the SMS Bros sailed to Mundra, where customs records reviewed by the journal show that on April 17th, Adani Enterprises imported a load matching the cargo described in the shipping documents with a declared value of just over $7 million. A third party. Purchasers of Iranian oil and gas products often use forged documents from Oman and Iraq, according to several people familiar with the trade. The Adani spokesman said the SMS Bros shipment was handled through a third-party logistics company, and documentation identifies the shipment as originating from Sohar. Adani companies check the vessels they contract for red flags, he added, but don't own, operate, or track vessels and can't comment on the activity of vessels they don't control. Whatever the duties of and responsibilities of a bona fide importer are, we have fulfilled those, the spokesman said. The SMS Bros, which changed its name to the Neil last year, has shown other discrepancies. A Bangladeshi port record from last June shows the SMS Bros as importing a load of LPG originating in Iran for an unknown importer, yet its AIS data reports making the same journey to Iraq that it did in April. At several other points over the past year, satellite images don't show the SMS Bros and its reported AIS position, according to Bjorn Bergman, a data analyst who tracks AIS spoofing at the nonprofits Global Fishing Watch and SkyTruth. Signs of obfuscation. Three other LPG tankers show some elements of obfuscation while making runs between Adani's Mundra port and the Persian Gulf, according to the journal's review of their data. One tanker operated by the same company that managed the SMS Bros showed similar signs of spoofing its AIS. That ship was also named on a list of tankers suspected of shipping Iranian oil and gas by a bipartisan group of U.S. senators. The company operating the ships, as well as the captain of the SMS Bros on its April 2024 journey, didn't respond to requests for comment. A third ship appears to have used similar tactics around its trips to Mundra, broadcasting via AIS, a stop in Khor Al Zubair that can't be seen on simultaneous satellite images of the port. A fourth tanker in the group, often making deliveries to Mundra, was listed in a 2024 report by the U.S. Energy Department as being involved in the export of Iranian petroleum products. In May, the journal found the ship was reporting its position on the railroad tracks of the port in Khor Al Zubair. In that article, Indian tycoon Adani under new U.S. scrutiny. Yusuf Khan and Clara Hudson write our next article, Climate Startups Cut Staff, Pause Projects as Policy Shifts. Climate startups are feeling the impact of President Trump's attacks on the energy transition sector as funding and job cuts, operational halts, and bankruptcies rack up. From carbon capture to solar power, companies across the clean tech spectrum are reeling from funding withdrawals, policy changes, and import restrictions brought in by the Trump administration as it is set about dismantling the climate goals of its predecessor. On Friday, the Energy Department announced $3.7 billion of funding cuts for clean energy and climate projects, with a large portion of the canceled grants focused on carbon capture and sequestration. Of 24 projects terminated in the move, 16 were signed between Election Day and Trump's inauguration, the department said. There are going to be some companies that do fall away because they do not have strong fundamentals, said Amy Dufour, general partner at Azola Ventures, a climate-focused venture capital investor. But a lot of high-quality companies that do not receive the funding will not scale. Last week, Republicans moved to roll back tax credits for solar, hydrogen, and other clean energy sources, while a number of government departments are exploring whether or not to keep billions of dollars worth of funds in place for projects such as carbon capture and storage. The impact of tariffs also hit the sector hard, pushing up prices for imports. The move marks a sharp reversal to the policies of the previous administration, which pumped billions of dollars into the sector, supercharging startups in the field and attracting automakers, battery manufacturers, and solar producers from across the globe to set up shop in the U.S. because of the generous incentives offered by the government. Now those companies are figuring out how to do it on their own as funding is pulled. In the past month, Li-Cycle, a Canadian battery recycling startup that aimed to build large facilities in Rochester, New York, filed for bankruptcy, while Climeworks, a Swiss direct air capture startup, said it was cutting nearly a quarter of its staff amid uncertainty over whether millions of dollars in grants from the Energy Department would remain in place for its joint venture plant in Louisiana. Both declined to comment for this article. The policy changes pummeled stock prices of some clean energy companies that went public in recent years. First Solar said its earnings report that Trump's tariffs would significantly raise costs for imports. Its stock is down 22% since the inauguration. Hydrogen startup Plug Power shares are down nearly 66% in the same period and have fallen into penny stock territory, with the company announcing job cuts amid revenue struggles. Shares of Sunrun, a solar power provider, is down 24%. All companies were hit by news that tax credits for businesses working in the renewables field could be rescinded. Plug said it was continuing to monitor the evolving landscape, while First Solar declined to comment. Group 14, a Seattle silicon battery maker, said it was delaying opening its battery factory in Moses Lake, Washington, due to uncertainty over Trump's tariffs, and was unsure whether a Silane production plant would be receiving $200 million in grant funding it had been contracted under the bipartisan infrastructure law. Silane is a gas used to produce silicon for batteries. What we're seeing is just uncertainty from the tariff conversation, said Rick Luby, chief executive. He added that it had asked local contractors to pause some of their construction work on the site, with the opening having been expected within the next month, now delayed into next year. Companies in the sector are likely to be stress testing to see if projects could still go ahead without public financing, according to Gabe Rubio at consulting firm BDO. He said the industry weathered shifts like this before. If you go on LinkedIn, the industry is saying the sky is falling, he said. I think that can be tempered with the fact that these tax credits have been changed many times over the years. To the surprise of Democrat policymakers, the move to roll back the subsidies put in place is likely to hit red states hardest, with much of the grant money flowing to Republican-controlled regions, something which had been thought of as a way of protecting the measures put in place by the last administration. That included Group 14's Moses Lake plant set in rural Republican County, though Luby added that to pull funding would likely require an act of Congress. In the short term, there are some purchasing decisions that could be affected by tariffs, etc., so it may have some impact on supply chains in the very near term. But in the long term, folks are in wait-and-see mode, he said. Gianna Amador, executive director at the nonprofit Carbon Removal Alliance, said the current policy landscape could mean the U.S. is losing the leadership it built in the clean technology industry, noting that, especially in sectors like carbon removals, U.S. funding has allowed the country to develop and attract companies to the region. This is unfortunately a tale that's been seen before, Amador said, citing the U.S. previous lead in research in solar energy, but failed to capitalize, with most manufacturing being centered in Asia. And that's climate startups cut staff, pause projects as policy shifts. We'll turn now to the Heard on the Street section of the Wall Street Journal for part of this article, Why NVIDIA Can't Just Quit China. Despite booming demand elsewhere, growth would still be hindered without the world's second largest economy. Given all the trouble NVIDIA has selling its artificial intelligence chips in China, one might wonder why the company even bothers trying anymore. The answer is, it can't really afford not to. NVIDIA used its fiscal first quarter report last week to send a rather stark message to the Trump administration about the dangers of shutting American chip companies out of the Chinese artificial intelligence market. China's AI moves on with or without U.S. chips, NVIDIA chief executive Jensen Huang said on the company's conference call, making the point that half the world's AI developers are in China. Huang argued that preventing U.S. companies from competing there could ultimately cost America its leading position in the global AI industry. In the end, the platform that wins the AI developers wins AI, Huang said. Export controls should strengthen U.S. platforms, not drive half the world's AI talent to rivals. NVIDIA also has powerful financial reasons to make that argument. The U.S. government's decision in April to stop the company from selling its H2O chips to the Chinese market cost the company about $2.5 billion in lost sales in the April-ended quarter and will cost another $8 billion in the current period ending in July. That's because the H2O chip was designed specifically for the Chinese market to comply with then-current export restrictions, so it isn't really sellable anywhere else. Demand for NVIDIA's AI chips is still booming in the rest of the world, so the lost China sales don't hurt much in the near term. But NVIDIA is now valued at around $3.3 trillion, triple the market cap of the next largest chip company, precisely because investors think it still has a long runway of significant growth ahead. Wall Street analysts expect NVIDIA's annual revenue to cross the $200 billion mark this year and hit $300 billion by 2028, according to consensus estimates from FactSet. That's unlikely to happen without China. The world's second largest economy is pursuing AI development with a passion. Venture funds backed by the Chinese government invested $184 billion into AI startups between 2000 and 2023, according to a Morgan Stanley report last month. NVIDIA estimates the total addressable market in China for AI accelerators, the primary chips used in artificial intelligence computing, to be around $50 billion. China is a quarter of the market. It's a big number, UBS analyst Tim Arcuri said in an interview. He added NVIDIA would have a dominant hold on that market if it were able to compete there. Wall Street analysts haven't given up on NVIDIA getting back into the Chinese AI market. We remain convinced that there will be at least some recovery of the Chinese opportunity, Joe Moore of Morgan Stanley wrote following NVIDIA's latest earnings report. But a change at this point would require the Trump administration to either backtrack or seriously modify current rules that place sharp limits on the computing ability of chips sold into China, and that seems unlikely, at least given the most recent developments. On Friday, for instance, President Trump accused China of violating its recent trade deal with the U.S., threatening a rebound in tensions. Arcuri of UBS thinks modifications that allow more powerful chips to be sold could still comport with the administration's aims, since restrictions on advanced chipmaking gear still limit China's abilities to actually produce the most advanced processors. If those equipment restrictions don't change, there is this inherent ceiling to what they, China, can do, Arcuri said. NVIDIA's absence from the Chinese AI market is giving local competitors such as Huawei a leg up. Morgan Stanley estimates China is able to supply about 34% of its AI chip needs now, with local suppliers with that self-sufficiency ratio reaching 82% in 2027. And if NVIDIA does make it back into the market, it will still have to contend with the Chinese government's ambitions to have homegrown tech at the heart of all its key industries. NVIDIA is considered years ahead of any of its rivals now in its growing ecosystem of chips. Full systems and software tools for AI developers would still be a major draw for Chinese companies looking to stay competitive in AI globally. NVIDIA needs to get back into China, but the road there runs straight through the White House. That article was by Dan Gallagher, Why NVIDIA Can't Just Quit China. You've been listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org, the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, or streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo.